Welcome to the Core Principles Podcast. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope you'll enjoy this lively discussion of relevant topics, which we attempt to examine through the lens of unchanging, objective truth. Here's the host of the Core Principles Podcast, Clay Howerton.
Thank you, Suzanne. Today on Core Principles, we're going to be talking with Daniel Greenfield about his upcoming book called Domestic Enemies. During the conversation, we'll be referring regularly to the term leftists. So I want to take a moment to remind listeners precisely what that term means. Left and right, in the context of governance, refers to positions on the political spectrum. That political spectrum has to have at least two characteristics to be of value and to make sense. The first characteristic is that the political spectrum must measure the parameter of greatest relevance to citizens regarding our relationship to government. That parameter is how much involvement and control government has in our lives. The second characteristic of a meaningful and useful political spectrum is that the opposite ends must be opposite. They cannot be the same. The opposite extremes of how much involvement and control government has in citizens' lives are total control and no control. By convention, those extremes have been labeled left and right. The left extreme is tyranny, the right extreme is anarchy, and both of those extremes are disastrous. The founders of the United States had escaped tyranny, and so were obviously averse to leftism. The early Articles of Confederation were quite far to the right, just enough government to not be actual anarchy. Then the Constitution of the United States found what seems to me to be the sweet spot on the political spectrum, slightly to the right, with what we would call strictly limited government. When I use the term leftists, I refer to people who want or pursue government that is involved in citizens' lives beyond those strict limits set forth in the Constitution of the United States. The founders of the United States recognize the unfortunate but inescapable reality that a slide towards leftism rarely stops short of tyranny because government grows and grows but doesn't tend to shrink back to proper limits. To prove this to yourself, try to think of any temporary government power or program that ever really went away. If you'd like to know more about the strict limits on government set forth in our Constitution, of course, the first thing to do is to read it, but you can also listen to the Core Principles episode called Enumerated Powers. Meanwhile, remember that the 10th Amendment, which was the conclusion of the Constitution as ratified, tells the government that it is absolutely forbidden to exceed those limits. Anything the Constitution does not specifically allow the federal government to do, it explicitly prohibits the federal government from doing. Leftism is tyranny, and leftists, whether by ignorance or malice, push things that will either be tyranny or will lead to tyranny. Therefore, every leftist is an enemy of liberty. Now, I'm proud to welcome back to Core Principles an investigative journalist and the Shulman Journalism Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, the author of a great new book coming out next week on the 30th of April called Domestic Enemies, Daniel Greenfield. How are you doing today, Daniel?
I'm good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. I really enjoyed the book. I'm looking forward to diving into at least a little bit to whet the appetite of the listeners. And I often start interviews with authors of books by asking what motivated the project. In this case, you stated one of your motivations really plainly near the conclusion of the book. You said, quote, "I believe history matters not just as a reservoir of obscure trivia, but because the past, the present, and the future share a single common destiny, end quote. And some people might hear that and conjure debates about free will versus predestination and this sort of thing. But if we learn from history, we surely have some hope of shaping that destiny. So my first question, Daniel Greenfield, is this. It's going to go right to the punchline of the whole thing. With all of the powerful forces that are pushing towards tyranny, will we be able to preserve liberty?
We can. The choice is very much ours, as Benjamin Franklin told an elderly lady who asked him. It's a republic if we can keep it. If we can keep it is the crucial part. Nothing just magically operates on its own. And as Americans, we've really become complacent. We thought that we were immune to the forces of history, that the same effects that tore apart so many other countries that brought down so many empires in the past would not affect us. And it is very much a republic if we can keep it. Everything we do every day, every year, every generation is really what determines whether we can keep it or not. And obviously, at the moment, we are not doing a particularly good job of keeping it. But to understand those forces, to understand what we are up against, it is really important to understand where we came from, where the enemy came from, where the left arose, and how we fought in the past. And that is really why this book exists.
Yes. Listeners are familiar with Patrick Henry, of course, and his famous plea, "Give me liberty or give me death." But you quote him from that same speech that he gave, that he concluded with that famous line, where he amplified your focus on the importance of understanding history. He said, quote, "I have but one lamp by which my feet are guided, and that is the lamp of experience. I know of no way of judging the future, but by the past," end quote. So, Daniel Greenfield, it clearly matters who is teaching history. And now, today, we see universities that are notoriously teaching false history. I can think of one prime example people have heard of, the 1619 Project. How can we thwart the false historical indoctrinations and educate Americans on relevant, true history?
So the 1619 Project was actually one of my inspirations. One way I view this book is as a 1619 Project for the left, because what so often happens, especially once the left was able to take over the culture, once it was able to take over academia, is we know as conservatives, we know that what the left is telling us now is a lie. But very often, and I see this all the time, the things that the left was telling us a generation ago, those things people accept uncritically. And it's just a matter of what age you are, what generation you are, the generation before you, the things that you grew up with, those just become part of your reality. And it's very important to actually draw a larger picture of where we came from, what we stand for, as the only way to demolish all that. And this is part of what I hope to do with Domestic Enemies. But it's really bigger than that. It's about bigger than one book. It's about the idea that we have to get back to where we came from. We were a revolutionary nation. We were a nation that set out certain basic principles, one of those which is that our rights come from God. They do not come from a government. They're not relative rights. What the left now does is it holds up relative rights, which is, and that is a big part of its hijacking of history. What it says is that history is the process of giving rights to people who did not previously have rights. So we have the civil rights movement, and we have the gay rights movement. We have feminism. Now we have transgender rights. And rights are entirely relative. We destroy the existing structure of rights because it's oppressive, and we give more rights to more people. And the left exists in order to continue this destructive process of taking away privilege from those who have it and giving it to those who do not. This Marxist level of reading of history has been incorporated at a gut level by really, I think, even most conservatives, certainly most Republicans, have accepted some aspect of this distorted version of history. And it's completely opposed to the basic principles of the founding of this country. And it is really vital that we understand that.
Indeed. That's the name of my program, Core Principles. It's the things that don't change. I really appreciate that a lot. Now, your book, Domestic Enemies, shares some of the relevant true history about how leftists have always sort of warred against America, at least as far as we know America as the land of liberty. Leftism really is not compatible with liberty. It's tyranny or a path to tyranny. They have been pushing this, even if they don't think it's going to be tyranny, they've been pushing this bogus idea of utopia that can't come unless the government's got total control. So let's look at some examples and give listeners a little taste of what they will learn from your book. Now, folks who have watched the musical Hamilton know about Aaron Burr as the man who killed Alexander Hamilton in a duel, but you document some of Burr's more nefarious acts, most of which I did not know. How did Aaron Burr subvert the founding principles of this nation?
Well, in the book, I call Aaron Burr really the first community organizer in the country, and he absolutely was. He was also the unsung father of the Democratic Party, or what would eventually become the Democratic Party. He ushered in a lot of the ways in which elections are run today, which is, first of all, machine politics. You know, when America first started, you did not really have this idea of, first of all, the party system. The party system took a bit of a while to develop. Aaron Burr was a major progenitor of the party system. And in the past, you would simply start it out with, you would have eminently qualified men, like George Washington, men who did not actually even want to serve. They did not seek out public office, who would have it thrust on them. And Washington literally had public office thrust on him against his will. You know, we have the joke, if nominated, I will not serve, and all that. There was a time when this was actually a serious thing. So Aaron Burr upended all that. He used very blunt power politics. I think a good way to look at him is as the Obama of his day. He understood how the system worked, how it could be exploited. He was very much a radical leftist. He was part of the Democratic Society of New York. And back then, the Democratic Societies, before there was a Democratic Party, were inspired by revolutionary France. They wanted to bring the French Revolution to America to topple everything they considered to be aristocratic, which included Washington. And Burr actually had a lot of ingenious ideas for how to do that. Cities were not a major influence in politics. Today, politics is dominated by cities. And he took a look at New York City, or what was then New York City, which was actually a small slice of Manhattan for the most part. And he looked at all this, you know, all these different groups, immigrant groups, people who were not right there and then on the voting rolls. And he began thinking, how can I get all these people on the voting rolls? And he actually had a brilliant idea, which we've mostly forgotten about, which was that there were pandemics back then, too. Back then, there was something called the yellow fever. There would be regular outbreaks of this. People didn't know exactly what caused it, but they wanted to fix it by getting clean water. So Aaron Burr went ahead. He created his own water company to be chartered by the government that would give him total control over the water system. He used that to then create a bank, and everybody who was going to be a Democratic voter suddenly was getting loans from this bank that enabled them to be on the voting rolls, and a whole lot of voters now showed up. This was, of course, just part of his plan, but it really ushered in modern politics. He had big data. He had information on all the voters. He figured out new ways to create new voters, something that the Democrats have been doing in a major way since. And he created the first urban political machine, which was Tammany Hall, which became the Democratic Party of New York, and which used very much modern organizing techniques, which was not based on bringing people together or giving them options. It was about making them subjects of a particular political party, bribing them, making their employment, their careers, their lives dependent on this political party. And Aaron Burr brought all of that together. He, as a result, he became vice president of the United States. He nearly became president, but that is also another part of the story.
It is a fascinating story. And like I say, I did not know most of those details before reading your book, Domestic Enemies. Another of the historical episodes you document in Domestic Enemies didn't just surprise me, it shocked me. I think on reflection now, I should not have really been shocked, but we can observe leftists, they tend to reject reality, whether that's because they're seeking this unreal vision of utopia or because they just cannot accept their accountability to the creator of the real universe. Whatever the reason, they reject reality, and that leads to what I'm going to call perverse ideas. Not just regarding the government, but also regarding interpersonal relationships. And we haven't seen, for example, the list of Jeffrey Epstein's clients, probably because the leftists who control the information these days are finding the people on the list are fellow travelers on the left. We have been sad to observe things like Joe Biden's obvious, disgusting attraction to little children, and we avoid thinking about these kind of things because they're just gross, frankly. But if you'll take us back 200 years or so, Daniel, and tell us who Fanny Wright was and how she represented some of the dangers of leftism.
So we think about communes as some sort of Woodstock phenomenon. That's another example of actually not knowing where a lot of this came from. Communes were actually much older than that. Their goal was to eliminate all the various traditions. So they would create this kind of space. It's like they do with Chaz now. We create this autonomous space where we can abolish all the moral and religious principles of the society. And America was a perfect target for communes in the early 19th century because there was so much space. There was a whole lot of land. And you could just come up there and set up shop unless you were too close to a more traditional community. Even before the American Revolution, there would be attempts to set up communes, often kind of cult ones. But after the actual founding of America, you had the first socialist communes. They called the members of those communes communists. Now, we think it's something that's associated with the 20th century. They were calling them communists now because they abolished private property and it would also abolish marriage. One of the interesting figures I focus on is Fanny Wright, who actually had a good deal of impact in our politics, though we've forgotten her. She began by trying to set up a commune where they would abolish marriage and would bring all sorts of prominent people there. Her particular commune failed because it depended on slave labor. She was doing this in the South, and she expected to be able to bring a whole lot of slaves there. That plan eventually failed. But there was another guy named Robert Owen. He was known as the father of British socialism. He came into this country in a big way. He began setting up multiple communes. He was able to address Congress, along with the President of the United States, on two occasions to explain his big idea, which was that people are entirely dependent on society. Whatever society makes you into, you will be. If you create a commune where you can shape the next generation, you can shape the children. This is something Fanny Wright also tried to do. If you can take away the children from their parents, you control their education, you can make them anything you want to be. Owen set up multiple communes across the country. They also eventually failed. But then they began working on something that we know now as the public school system. The idea of just bringing a whole bunch of these people and creating a commune where people would work for a living did not work. You know, Bernie Sanders tried to be on the commune. He didn't do any work. These guys don't tend to work when they get in the commune. But they decided that if the government comes in, creates public education, you control the education of the children, then you can reshape the entire country and all of society. So what began really on these communes, and I call them sex cults because in some cases they really were sex cults, they're about abolishing marriage and religion, they brought that into the public school system, and that is still something we are dealing with today.
Sadly, we are, and it's getting more and more shocking, the things that are going on. And of course now, concerned parents go to a school board and say, hey, this is really not what I'm paying you for. The FBI says you might be a terrorist. It's just shocking. Well, another aspect of leftism that I observe is that leftists dehumanize other people. They dehumanize babies, for example. That's how they justify abortion. They dehumanize adults, choosing instead to see them as parts of collectives, organizing them by such things as skin color. What was the group, the Knights of the Golden Circle, and how did they spawn the more well-known arm of the Democratic Party called the Ku Klux Klan?
So the Knights of the Golden Circle have been mostly forgotten, but they were a key element in the Democratic plot to transform America. Back in the day, the Democrats had wanted to expand. Manifest Destiny to some meant that we would actually move westward onto California. But for others, they were thinking of, again, building this larger socialist revolution. So I mentioned already the origins of the Democratic Party were tied in with the French Revolution. The French Revolution, like the Communist Revolution, the Soviet Union, was never really supposed to be limited to France. It was supposed to be an international, a global revolution that would topple, you know, all the various monarchies, but also usher in these ideal socialist states. They tried to bring that to America with very limited success, but they also wanted to use America to expand the revolution internationally. And their idea was that they were going to expand up into Canada, then down into Mexico. And instead of the civil war that would eventually come, they would have this kind of push to create these ideal regimes all across the continent and then eventually expanded into Europe. There are kind of building blocks, pieces of things we don't properly understand, like the Statue of Liberty that were supposed to be part of this larger agenda. All this is going on about a decade or so before the Civil War. And their big idea is that they are going to bring in these individual groups. The Knights of the Golden Circle were a key part of that element. They were going to filibuster their way into Mexico and to other places and establish a colonial outpost over there in order to liberate them and make them into proper leftist regimes. During the Civil War, they became more like domestic terrorist groups. And after the Civil War, they evolved into something called the KKK, which once again focused on, you know, local terrorism, but was also a key part of the Democratic strategy because the Democrats really vitally dependent on suppressing votes of Republicans. And that is really what a lot of these domestic terrorist groups were, whether it was the draft riots in New York, which I go into in the final chapter, or other riots. The original race riots were about suppressing Republican votes, and they go back quite a ways.
Now let's fast forward to current times. Current events. We're seeing on college campuses these indoctrinated leftist students just supporting things that I can't wrap my brain around how they can be pro-terrorism, pro-Hamas. We look at what happened on the 7th of October last year. Hamas set out to just kill as many Jewish people as possible because they want, from the river to the sea, they want every Jewish person on the planet to die. And we've got these students in American universities saying, yay, go Hamas, you know, kill them all. I am disgusted by this, but I wanted to get your take, Daniel Greenfield, on what has led to that level of depravity and what hope do we have for sort of cleaning that up?
You mentioned that parents who went to school boards were treated like terrorists by the FBI and the Biden administration. Meanwhile, students who actively campaign for terrorists, of course, are treated as advocates and engaged in free speech. But what the response, you know, the scenes we're seeing in Columbia or Yale or other places are less shocking. If we remember that back in the day in the 60s and the 70s, student groups were rallying, actively agitating for communist regimes around the world that were murdering millions of people. Think about communist China, for that matter. Going back even further, the Bolshevik Revolution and the Soviet Union, the mass murders in Cuba, the Cambodian genocide. So they were always rallying for the for leftist mass murders of huge numbers of people. And by the way, plenty of Jews were being killed in the Soviet Union, not to mention plenty of Christians. So there is a long history of student radicalism, which called for mass murder, but we should not just assume that they mean mass murder abroad. I just actually finished an article about the left and the history of the campus left, in which, you know, I note the Weather Underground, the Weathermen, and at one point, Larry Grandwell, who had infiltrated them, described this meeting that were being held. All these people are in the room, there are 25 people in the room, and they all have degrees from Columbia or so. And they're discussing what to do when they take over America. And they discuss how they're going to have to probably kill 25 million Americans. And we would be kidding ourselves to think that they do not think the same way, except they probably now not thinking about 25 million, but maybe 50 or 60 million. You've got to account for population growth after all. So this is really what the left has been about for quite a while. It's a revolutionary movement. I trace it right back to the French Revolution. And there were other revolutions in Europe which were unsuccessful, but were also ultimately very murderous. The left really follows a kind of very basic program, which is that they claim society is unjust and unfair. It's oppressive. It needs to be taken over by the people who are actually going to remedy things. And by remedying things, they're going to have to ruthlessly impose their rule and kill everybody who's on the wrong side of it. And the French Revolution, by the way, was not just killing large numbers of aristocrats. You know, we have the scene of the guillotine and everybody's being taken in the cart to the guillotine. They were also engaged in mass purges of people in rural parts of France, particularly people who were more traditional, who were opposed. One of the things the French Revolution did at its peak was it replaced religion, replaced Christianity, all traditional religion, with their own religion. They created their own calendar. Again, this is stuff the left does whenever it actually gets the opportunity to really take power. And they began massacring anybody who stood in the way of their utopian, their ideal society. And this is the blueprint for every revolution that the left has executed 200 years hence. This is what they would like to do in America today. So what we're seeing on college campuses is really the same movement that's been around for 200 years, which is you back the people who are going to overthrow the society, no matter how evil they are. Actually, the more evil they are, the better they are, because there is a sizable part of the left that really glories in the atrocities. You know, people try to shame them by showing them, look at all the babies they killed. Well, you know, what about Planned Parenthood? What about all the children that they killed in China through famine, through their one-child policies? You know, this is really what the left does. It glories in atrocities. It looks at atrocities and says, yes, this is true revolutionary commitment. So there's a long, ugly history to this. And to fix it, which is the second part of your question, we need to get, we don't just need to get the Hamas supporters off the campus. We need to get the activist left off the campuses. This happened because the left basically turned into a neighborhood in San Francisco. It became a $90,000 a year chazzes, where there's a political monoculture. Conservative professors, students get pushed out of campuses. And that means there's absolutely no breaks whatsoever on the left. The liberals become leftists, the leftists become Marxists, the Marxists become communists, and no atrocity, no agenda, nothing is too horrifying for them to embrace. We need to take back the campus. We need to turn it into a place that actually has rigorous study, critical thinking, a dedication to existing American values. If we don't do that, if we don't restore the college to what it was, then we might as well defund it, because it is just a destructive force in American life.
Maybe also why Biden wants to buy all their votes by saying your education is now paid for by these suckers who did the work, rather than by you who went and listened to our garbage. Incredible. Well, listeners, Daniel Greenfield and I have only hinted at some of the valuable lessons from history that you can learn in the book, and you can see they apply right now, today. The book is called Domestic Enemies. It releases on the 30th of April. In the book, you're also going to read about early examples of fake news. He hinted about pandemic fear-mongering, stolen elections. It's all current events, but with a historical perspective and how these things have been going on for years. So thank you again, Daniel, for joining me on Core Principles, and have a blessed day.
Thank you so much.
Core Principles Podcast is produced in Paducah, Kentucky by Real Productions. Music is by Late July, L-E-I-G-H-T July. You can find her music on all streaming services or at latejuly.com. Thank you for joining us today for this episode of the Core Principles Podcast. Please visit core.buzzsprout.com for more information, and please share with your friends. We look forward to visiting with you again on our next episode.